comes true. I know that the angels will watch over you. At night, wherever you are.
Hi, this is Alan Shartok. I'm very excited because back with us again to discuss D-Day and how that day sounded to the millions who were transfixed by their radios are Dr. Ivan Steen and Dr. Anne Pfau. And today we'll bring you more sound from that historic day. A writer and historian, Dr. Pfau earned her PhD in U.S. history from Rutgers University. She's currently working on a biography of Mildred Gillers, better known as Axis Sally, the notorious World War II radio announcer. Dr. Ivan Steen has been on the faculty at the University of Albany for more than 45 years and currently serves as Vincent O'Leary Associate Professor of History. He's co-director of the Center for Applied Historical Research. Dr. Steen has conducted oral history interviews with radio performers from the 40s and 50s and has taught a course on the golden age of radio. Today, Dr. Ivan Steen and Dr. Anne Pfau will once again guide us through several selections from the radio broadcasts of D-Day, the Allied invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944. Hey, guys, thank you both for being back and with us today.
Good to be here, Alan.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, Ivan Steen, perhaps you can tell us where we're going.
Well, what we're doing is we're looking at the next day and the kinds of information that's being put out by radio to the American public. All of the broadcasts we have here came on either the 7th of June or a day or two later. So the whole mystique or whatever it is of D-Day is being kept before the American public by radio, and it lasts for some time.
Now, I do remember you told us the last time, and we paid attention to you, that there were those people who we heard from on day one who were somewhat tentative. In other words, we heard from the president of the United States say, we may have to come back again and again, but we'll get there. So by the time we get to day two, there's a better sense of things.
Yeah, by the time we get to day two, we're getting more reports from the battlefield because recordings have gotten back. They couldn't broadcast directly from the battlefield in those days, but now they're getting the recordings. They're putting those on the air. People are now assessing what has happened. There's still an element of, you know, we've got to be careful. It's been going well, but things could change, so it's not over. We're not just in there yet.
In fact, you hear a lot of warnings against over-optimism, overconfidence.
So I'm fascinated by the fact that you're writing this book on Axis Sally. What were the Germans doing propaganda-wise while all this was happening?
Well, they were saying that this is a very, very costly invasion and that the victory isn't determined and that a lot of American men and women are going to lose their loved ones.
And did they have Axis Sally saying that?
Axis Sally said it, and a lot of other people said it, including her lover, Dr. Otto Koschwitz.
Tell us very quickly about who he was.
He was a German-American professor. He worked at Hunter College as a professor. He left in 1939 with his family to work for the Nazi government. He worked in the Foreign Office and was actively involved in radio broadcasting. He was also Axis Sally's superior at the Rundfunk.
So, Ivan Steen, start us out.
Well, we had some battlefield reporting in our last D-Day broadcast, and now some really interesting battlefield reporting is coming through that was actually recorded on the scene using much earlier, more primitive recording equipment than we have today. The first selection we're going to listen to is by the reporter Charles Collingwood, who was quite well known. He worked for CBS. He was hired by Edward R. Murrow, and in fact, Edward R. Murrow will be introducing him. And actually, this is in the afternoon on D-Day that he actually did this recording. So why don't we listen to Charles Collingwood?
This is London. Late on the afternoon of D-Day, Charles Collingwood took his recording gear in a little 36-foot LCVP onto a French beach. Nearing the beach, the water was filled with floating objects. Part of a parachute, a K-ration box, a life jacket, wreckage from a ship, shell cases. Here is part of the recording.
This is Charles Collingwood. We are on the beach today, on D-Day. We've just come in. We caught a ride in a small boat which came in from our LST loaded with 1,000 pounds of TNT. half a ton of high explosive on this beach, which is still under considerable enemy gunfire. While we have been here, we have just seen one of the strangest and most remarkable sights of this invasion so far. Two great fleets of over 100 gliders have gone overhead, towed by C-47 transports, who are certainly proving the workhorses of this invasion. They've hauled them right over the beaches, and it seems as though the German gunners, amazed at this incredible sight, have stopped firing on the beach now because it's quiet here, and the second batch are droning over now. I can see them. They're casting off the gliders as they circle around over the beach, and the transports are circling around and beginning to make off home. Where they're landing, we don't know, because we're down here on the beach, and there's a seawall in front of us, and we can't see the land behind. This is the way the beach looks, which was hit by our troops about 12 hours ago, early this morning. It's a flat, sandy beach, like almost any beach that you're likely to see, and it slopes gently away from the shore, from the seashore, up to the dunes and then to the sea wall, which was the first objective of our troops and which they took early on in the game. Since that time, we have been able to bring in quite a bit of equipment. There are various trucks and jeeps and motor vehicles of all kinds here. There are also anti-aircraft guns. We've breached the seawall in various places and have set up guns there to defend against any possible enemy counterattack on the beaches, which has not occurred. A naval party has just come in from the shore and begun to unload our TNT here, which is taking a load off my mind as well as a load off this vessel. And I asked him how things were going, and he said that it was pretty rough still. I asked him how far the troops had gone on inshore, and he said that they'd got 5 or 6 miles inshore, which sounds as though they're making good progress. He said that the beach was still under considerable gunfire. The Germans had some 88s, which we hadn't been able to silence. These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed, and it must have been a rugged fight to get it, although as nearly as we can see, there is not a great deal of evidence of damage. Perhaps that's because it has been smoothed up. We can look on down the coast now and see this flat part of the beach, which joins the water, going all the way down to the lower beach, which is marked for us by columns of white smoke which are rising from it. And further up at the end of this beach, we can see another huge column of white smoke, which has apparently been caused by naval gunfire. Looking out to sea, all we can see of the vast invasion fleet which is assembled for us are the silhouettes of the big warships, the battleships and cruisers, which have been putting a steady bombardment against the enemy positions all day. We can also see a few of the transport, but the fleet of LCTs and LCIs and other craft, which we have brought and assembled back maybe 10 miles offshore, is invisible from us at this moment.
Okay, so that is so great, because you get a sense of standing on that beach. And since we didn't have television, he was great in terms of descriptions, physical descriptions of what's happening.
Yeah. No, he really did a great job. Perhaps we should just enlighten some people who don't know. An LCI is landing craft infantry, and an LCT is landing craft tank. So they're on various kinds of LC kind of ships that we're going to hear here. But it is truly amazing that he was out there and recording this. And I think a lot of that noise we have is actually wind sound coming through the microphone.
Mm. When I was in New Orleans at the World War II Museum, which is unbelievable, it's the home of the guy who invented the boats which came down in the front. And Eisenhower said he was the man who won World War II, because it really was the delivery of those men that made it all
right,
possible.
Right, with that big flat kind of ramp that was the front of the ship, and then it would just drop down and they could come right out of it. Really amazing.
One thing I thought we might talk about with Collingswood, which is interesting, is while this is a recording From the first day of the invasion, it wasn't heard till several days later because the recording had to be physically transported from France to London to be broadcast to the United States.
A very important distinction.
Yeah.
So who was George Hicks?
George Hicks is a very interesting person. He was a radio announcer, actually, who became a war correspondent and had worked through the invasion in Italy. He worked for the Blue Network just after it split off from NBC, which had been really two networks, the Red Network and the Blue Network. And the Blue Network later became ABC. And he convinced his superiors to set up a London office with him in it. In fact, he was it. They had very little budget in those early years. So George Hicks was the London office. This D-Day broadcast that we're going to hear a piece of was really his greatest moment. It's considered an absolute classic of battlefield recording. And for those interested in anything technical, he used what's called a film spool recorder, which is kind of an early version of what we had later as reel-to-reel tape recorders.
You know, Ivanstein, I was born in 1941. Certainly, I remember a good deal of the guys we're talking about now, like Charles Collingwood.
Yeah.
I don't remember Mr. Hicks.
No.
Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, he didn't become as famous. He wasn't one of the Murrow boys, for example. And Collingwood stayed on with CBS and did a lot of important news broadcasts as a commentator. George Hicks, no, you don't hear much about him later. I'm not quite sure.
Let's hear his work now.
Let's do that.
Yet to see a German plane over the amphibious convoy, which doesn't necessarily mean that we shan't see them before the attack is over. Our air support has been found, and the loudspeakers call out almost constantly Spitfires on the fort, or Mustangs overhead, or B-17s passing on the starboard side. And as far as I know, no report has come in of attack by a Nazi sea craft onto the convoys. Now it's almost black dark, and you see the ships lying in all directions, just like black shadows on the gray sky, some signaling out to sea, sheltered on the inside from the Germans' eyes, signaling with red lights, blinking code. There are four fires on the shore, looking like pinpoints, winking, smudged by smoke. Now planes are going overhead. That baby was plenty low. I think I just made the statement that no German planes have been seen, and I think there was the first one we've seen so far. He came very low, just cleared our stack, and as he passed, he let go a stream of tracer that did no harm. And then just as that happened, there was a burst of fire on the coast just off of us 5 miles. I think you probably heard me. German planes have been in the sky now. The darkness is on us, and the tracers have been flying up. They seem to have withdrawn from them for the moment, but the plane that we just had come over our ship was the first Nazi we've seen so far. He took a pass at us and went on, and nothing particular happened. Our own ship has just gave its warning whistles, and now the flak is coming up in the sky in streamers from the warships behind us. The sparks seem to just float up in the sky, and we're too far away to hear their explosions. Heavy firing now just behind us, and anti-aircraft bursts in the sky, and bombs bursting on the shore and along in the convoys from the German planes that are beginning their first attack on the night of June 6th. Now the darkness has come on it. These planes you hear overhead now. Now the motors of the Nazis coming and going in the cloudy sky. Reverberation of bombs. Every once in a while you see a burst of fire from a bigger caliber on one of the warships firing up. That was a bomb hit. Another one. from the tracer line. Keep arcing up into the darkness. Very heavy fire now off our stern. Some more ships in that area. Fiery bursts. And the flak and steamer is going out in a diagonal slant. It's right for our half. Bursting open our heads from the captain's fire. Now it's died down. Blue-white flak right over our head. And we can't see the plane, nothing but the black burst of the Akak in the dark sky. Here comes the plane. More anti-aircraft fire. Inboard toward the shore. And the Germans must be attacking all of those planes off our stern because the streamer fire, the tracers, is almost parallel with the water. Hot tracer lines are coming up almost all around us. Off the stern and off the side toward the French colors. Flares are coming down now. You can hear the machine gunning. The whole sea side is covered with tracer fire. Going up, leading of the bombs, the machine gunning, and the planes come over closer. Fiery, low, fire down low toward the French coast, a couple of miles. I don't know whether it's on the shore or is a ship on fire. Here's very heavy Akak now, right? The
actually goes on for several more minutes. I cut it because we don't want to have to listen to all of it.
And the one nice moment that's cut is a point where Hicks says, after an attack, I need to stop talking for a moment. Just let me rest. And then continues on.
Talk about being in the thick of it. I mean, this one, he's really, really there. It's pretty amazing.
And I love the sort of off quote where he says, was that a bomb?
Yeah, right.
Well, one reason why this was so important and made such an impact was because Americans hadn't heard the sounds of war before. Or they might have heard it through Edward R. Murrow's rooftop broadcasts, but they hadn't heard it on the scene like this before because there was a ban on pre-recorded broadcasts that was lifted just before D-Day.
So, Ivan, tell us a little about Quentin Reynolds.
Well, Quentin Reynolds was a war correspondent who spent a lot of time in London, actually. He worked for CBS, but he was actually broadcasting in London to the British people, so he sort of became an important figure for the British as well as for the Americans. He was also an associate editor of Collier's magazine, was writing for them while he was abroad and commenting on the war. He also wrote 25 books. Pretty prolific guy. And this is a very interesting piece in which he talks about German soldiers.
Exactly 2.5 years ago today, that comfortable world we once knew came to an end. We didn't know very much about the Germans then. They were far away, remote. But during this past 2.5 years, we have learned a lot about both of our enemies. Today, our sons are learning even more about the Germans. His experiences in Sicily and in Italy have taught him to hate the German soldier and to know him for the ruthless, dirty fighter that he is. The Russians always called the Germans the Fritzies. The British civilians and soldiers called the Germans either the Jerrys or the Huns. Our boys, with fine contempt, called the Germans the Krauts. Usually real fighting men respect each other. Our men lost all respect for the Germans when they faced them in Sicily and later in Italy. In Sicily, our 1st Division saw the Germans raise a white flag of surrender on the top of a ridge. And when our men rushed up the hill to accept the surrender, they were met with murderous machine gun fire. This gave them an inkling as to what manner of enemy they were fighting. Again in Sicily, and any member of Oklahoma's 45th Division will attest to the truth of this, the Germans did something that perhaps no army in the history of military warfare has ever done. They booby-trapped their own dead, so that when our men went to bury them, mines tied to the bodies exploded, killing more than 20 of our boys. Now our troops finally realized that everything that we at home thought of the Japs was equally true of the Germans. They were hard, arrogant men, schooled in the belief that they were the master race. Since boyhood, they had marched and sung militant songs and lived only for the day when Hitler would turn them loose against our kind of civilization for which they had nothing but contempt. They threw the military rule book away when they went into action. In the short space of 2.5 years, we have trained an army that today is meeting these professional murderers on better than even terms. This is one of the greatest military miracles of the ages. Our men are good because they know their enemy. They don't underestimate him, as so many at home have underestimated him. They have talked to German prisoners, and they know now that this is a fight to the finish, with no holds barred, against an enemy which refuses to conform to even the most elementary rules of decency. Last September in Italy, we captured a great many German prisoners. I talked to some of them. One of them was wounded quite badly, and it looked as though he might die. The doctor asked him some questions. He asked him, for instance, "What is your religion?" The dying Nazi soldier lifted his head. Hatred gleamed from his eyes, and he spit out, "National socialism is my religion. Ich bin immer ein Nazi. I am a Nazi forever." This is the type of man our boys are fighting tonight. The Nazi ideology, which rejects God in favor of Hitler, is a religion to the German soldier. There is an old saying out in New Mexico, in the section of the state that still has a lot of rattlesnakes. Out there around Carrizozo, the rattlers sometimes take a sad toll of horses and cattle, and the cowmen are always on the alert against the poison of their fangs. They say out there, when you kill a rattler, you've got to kill him dead. You can't reform a rattlesnake or reason with him or convert him. The fighting men I've seen and talked to, after their experiences in Sicily and in Italy, feel that way about the Germans today. It may not be fashionable these days to hate, but I tell you that the men I've talked to abroad hate their enemy. This helps to keep their morale so high. Oh, back of the lines, when things get dull, our boys complain a lot. If you met them then, you'd think perhaps that their morale was bad. But don't forget that the morale of our men is always just as good as it has to be. It had to be good last night and throughout this long, long day. And it had to be good tonight. And every report that comes back to us confirms the fact that it was and is good. That spirits are high. These troops of ours know their enemy well. In 2.5 short years, they have been trained to deal with him. It looks as though that training had been well done indeed.
We selected this particular clip because we were interested by how Quentin Reynolds really encourages American civilians to hate Germans. It's a little bit unusual. Most of the hate propaganda was directed at this time at the Japanese. And you recall that on the West Coast, Japanese were detained by the U.S. government. There was a large German-American population in the U.S. who had been encouraged during the years before the war to really identify with the German homeland. So perhaps this is part of what's going on in this particular broadcast. And what's interesting is that despite Quentin Reynolds' assurance that American soldiers hated Germans, one thing that would become a problem once the U.S. soldiers get into German territory is that from the perspective of civilians, they're being a little bit too friendly with the German civilians, particularly young German women.
Well, the next person we're going to hear from is H.V. Kaltenborn, a very, very well-known news person. He was known as the Dean of American Commentators, primarily because his was the first radio commentary. His career, by the way, spanned 3 decades. He was fluent in German, Italian, and French. So he didn't need translators, so he could listen to broadcasts over shortwave and immediately know what's being said and talk about it. He became particularly famous, many people may remember, in 1948 when Harry Truman pulled an upset over Dewey in the election, and he mimicked H.V. Kaltenborn's prediction that Truman had lost
And he mimicked his voice, too.
he did an absolutely wonderful imitation. And when you listen to Kaltenborn, all you can think of is Harry Truman holding up that newspaper and talking as though he were H.V. Kaltenborn.
And one thing that's very interesting is the difference in how Kaltenborn sounds compared to Hicks, compared to Collingswood, right, compared to Murrow, who had a very kind of Midwest, not very fancy sort of accent, like a regular guy.
Well, this is an update that we're going to listen to that came in the afternoon of June 7th, and where he will talk about the significant progress we've made, but also was telling people to be cautious optimism, mm-hmm, because it just ain't over.
Well, and another interesting piece is that his information isn't just coming from the Eisenhower headquarters. Right. It's coming from German radio, and some of what he's saying is very speculative.
And in fact, as we know from the last conversation you guys had with us, it was in fact the Germans who we learned about D-Day from.
That's correct. All of these radio corporations were monitoring German broadcasts.
Right. They had listening stations, mm-hmm, where they would have teams of people constantly listening to German broadcasts. Well, let's listen to H.V. Kaltenborn.
The National Broadcasting Company brings you at this time the noted news analyst, H.V. Kaltenborn, with a mid-afternoon summary of the news.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's quite possible that before this broadcast is completed, we will be able to take you to London for an on-the-spot broadcast by one of our observers. But in the meantime, while we're checking up on the signal, I will carry on. Allied invasion forces have cleared the enemy from all of their beachheads in French Normandy. Today, they are fighting their way inland. The first heavy German counterattacks in the Caen area have already been beaten off. We have probably occupied the town of Bayeux near Caen, and the first mail has been delivered to our soldiers in France. Weather in the English Channel cleared up this afternoon, which helps enormously, both for air and overseas operations. The American, British, and Canadian assault forces are being reinforced constantly. Hundreds of gliders are shuttling thousands of troops into the Cherbourg Peninsula. Surface craft in large numbers are sailing into the coast. Large areas of French coastline have been freed from the Germans and are now available for safe landings. General Eisenhower's headquarters tells us that heavy fighting is raging inshore. The Germans are striking back against the expanding perimeter of the beachheads. They are putting up little resistance in the air and none at sea. The Berlin radio has just admitted that the Allies landed between 2 and 5 more divisions in France yesterday and last night. We lost 12 gliders and 12 C-47 transport planes during the past 24 hours in these transport operations. We must assume that Marshal Erwin Rommel is speeding armored and infantry divisions to the invasion zone. A full-scale counter-onslaught should develop within 24 hours. The more troops and material we are able to land before that assault comes, the better our chances of hanging on. All our reports indicate that the situation improved considerably last night and early today. Sharp German armored counterattacks in the Ghan area, 9.5 miles inland, have been beaten off. The Germans tell us we are now using 100 tanks in an offensive in that single area. The Germans may be emphasizing the importance of our mechanized equipment here to explain the setbacks which they are experiencing here. The Berlin radio has just reported that the Germans lost Bayeux. This town, close to the Normandy shore, is 16 miles northwest of Caen on the railway and highway to Cherbourg. It would probably be the first town we could take, since it is not far inland and lies between 2 of our well-established beachheads. Bayeux is near the center of our most concentrated operations on the Normandy Peninsula. This afternoon, 500 of our biggest bombers, escorted by fighters, attacked the road junctions in the Bayeux area. We are trying to isolate the strongly defended port of Cherbourg against the possibility of any German reinforcements. All beaches have now been cleared of the enemy in this area. Some of them have been linked together. This strengthens our position against counterattack. Our airmen report that the Normandy Peninsula today is dotted with fires. Some suggest that the Germans are carrying out demolitions preparatory to withdrawal. This seems over-optimistic. Shell fire and air bombs set many fires, and perhaps some forest fires. The Germans are following their usual practice of transporting troops by air to meet any sudden threat. British planes shot down 5 big Junkers 52 transport planes while on missions over France. The German radio says that Allied forces today attempted a landing in the Calais area of the French coast along the Straits of Dover. Berlin also asserts that Allied ships approached the French coast from the north, apparently bound through the Dover Straits for the invasion area. This may well be true, but we must be careful in interpreting what it means.
So we have some of this cautious optimism here. He's telling us all the great things that are happening, but we've got to be careful here. We haven't met the full force of the enemy yet and all the rest of that.
He did mention two things that are very interesting. One of course, was Rommel. Mm-hmm. Rommel had begged Hitler to let the panzers, be used, and they wouldn't wake Hitler up, as you remember, and there was all of that. And then also Calais. Now, there was a big expectation that that's where the landing was going to be and not in Normandy. And now, all of a sudden, we're sending troops there.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing was incredibly shrouded in secrecy, and we kept hitting them in places where they didn't expect to be hit. And that's why the initial invasion in most areas went very well for us. There were some areas where we really did get clobbered on that initial invasion. But we landed in so many places, really, that it took a while for the Germans to get their act together on this one.
But to get back to the idea of concerns about over-optimism among American civilians, and part of the reason this was important was because there was a worry that American civilians wouldn't support the war effort as thoroughly as they had just after the excitement of D-Day. And I think part of this is a reminder, and we'll hear it, I think, more clearly in the Kate Smith section we're going to hear right now.
Yes.
The concern was that, everyone was out giving blood, buying bonds, but can you continue that for months and months? Because this invasion wasn't over.
Yeah. Well, we can move to Kate Smith now, and that's one of the things she's doing. Kate Smith is, I think most people know, is a major radio personality. In fact, one of only two people who had no cancellation clauses in their contracts for radio. She's certainly very well known for having introduced Irving Berlin's God Bless America in 1938, and Berlin gave her exclusive rights to sing it.
Which has been played again and again on this station as soon as we are successful in a fight.
And during the seventh inning break at the Yankee Stadium, mm-hmm. they play Kate Smith's recording of God Bless America. So I think most people know that much about her, but not everything else. In any case, here she's telling people exactly what Anne was saying, that it's D-Day, but there's a lot of war left, there's a lot of things you have to do. So let's hear what Kate Smith has to say.
It's high noon in New York and time for Kate Smith, brought to you today by Sanka Coffee, the coffee that not only is delicious, but that always lets you sleep. Here she is, Kate Smith.
Hello, everybody. Well, Invasion Day has come and gone. The waiting and the tension are over. Now we know that our gallant armies are fighting on the mainland of Europe, fighting to restore to that enslaved continent its most precious possession, freedom. As you know, not many celebrations greeted the good news. In fact, most Americans preferred to be by themselves or with their families and listen to the radio bulletins. But churches all over the country were crowded with streams of worshipers passing in and out to ask divine protection for their loved ones. The people of the United States preferred to take D-Day seriously and prayerfully. There was no confetti, no wild demonstration. Instead, thousands of Americans responded to the good news in a much finer and better way. Throughout the country, they trooped to blood donor stations and war bond booths. War bond sales increased. Payroll offices of factories were swamped with bond buyers. Some cities started their fifth war loan drive early and have already sold their quotas. Yes, Americans are rallying behind our gallant armies of liberation storming Fortress Europe. But don't forget for one moment that the war is far from won. So here on the home front this noon, let's renew our determination to do everything we can to speed the day of victory for our fighting men. Let's volunteer at our blood donor stations again and again. Let's buy more bonds and keep on buying them. For if we can help end this war one day sooner, if our efforts can save the life of a single American boy, who can say that any sacrifice we can make is too great?
Well, that, you know, is just the pep talk for the American people. And we can move from here into listening to some of that being carried on. The selection we have next is Broderick Crawford, who was a sergeant in the Air Corps at that time. He'd enlisted, but was a very well-known stage and screen actor telling people to go out and buy bonds. We're up to the fifth war loan drive. And so I'll have a couple of words to say, and so will Anne after this. So let's just listen to it first.
Many of us will, of course, remember Broderick Crawford from Highway Patrol.
Yes, he was best known from that on the TV, yes.
Not me.
That's right. You had to be born in 41.
The Seacoast stands firing and fighting. It takes hard work, courage, and skill. But that's not all. It takes money as well, the dollars you've been putting into war bonds. The Fifth War Loan Drive is your chance to share in the invasion, to keep the sky over those Normandy beaches ours and ours alone. So buy bonds and hold on to them. That way you can join in the proud boast of every man of the Army Air Force's training command and say, I, too, sustain the wing.
This is Captain Ben Miller saying so long for all our gang. Next week, I Sustain the Wings will be brought to you by another band of the training command of the Army Air Forces with Captain Bob Jennings, the CO, and the music under the direction of Sergeant Harry Bluestone. We've enjoyed playing for you, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to us. Don't forget to listen again to I Sustain the Wings next Saturday, same time, same station. And remember, keep those V-mails flying to the boys overseas. They're doing the fighting. You do the writing. I Sustain the Wings is a presentation of the Army Air Force's Training Command and came to you from Chicago, Illinois.
That's an example of one of a number of programs that were done by, in this case, the Army Air Corps, but also the government sponsored a lot of programs during World War II. And notice the band leader was Captain Glenn Miller. Mm-hmm. That was not too long before his plane vanished and Glenn Miller just disappeared. I'd like to have Anne say a word or two about the V-mail, because I think some of the listeners may not be quite aware of what that was.
V-mail was actually a form that civilians and soldiers could write on. It was one sheet, one side. Those sheets were folded over. They were then microfilmed, They were censored and microfilmed and sent overseas as microfilm, so they took up a lot less storage space. And once they got overseas, they were blown up to quarter size. And so it was a really quick way to get a message across. And so, well, a lot of soldiers and their wives and their sweethearts preferred letters, airmail letters. V-mail was really convenient, particularly at times when information wasn't getting through. And sometimes there were months of delays in getting letters between someone in the U.S. and someone on continental Europe.
And when you compare that with Iraq, where you can be on the battlefield and then go and make a telephone call or
Skype and be
right.
Civil.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and it also means, so for example, if you're having a fight with your wife overseas, you have to wait 2 weeks to get her response at least.
And there were a lot of Dear John letters.
There were perhaps not as many as we like to think there were, but there were a lot of fights. There were a lot of misunderstandings. They had to be resolved not through email, not through direct conversation, but through letters that could take weeks to get to one another.
We have some more of these messages about the things the public can do in World War II. Among the most popular things on radio, of course, were soap operas that become legendary. People talk about them all the time. And one of the popular soap operas was one called Big Sister, which was supposedly set in the fictitious town of Glens Falls.
Yeah.
I think they thought it was a fictitious town, but there is a town by that name, as we all well know, in this area. We're going to get the opening of it, and then you'll hear the little message about the war in that.
This program will be interrupted immediately if there are any late news developments. Rentzel presents Big Sister. Yes, there's the clock in Glen Falls Town Hall, telling us it's time for Rinso's story of Big Sister, brought to you by Soapy Rich Rinso. R-I-N-S-O. Say, when you plan to try a product for the first time, what do? If you're the find-out-for-yourself type, you'll discover right off the bat that Rinso's swell Soapy Rich suds get clothes spanking clean with as little as a 5-minute run in your washer. However, if you're the take an expert's word for it type, you'll be glad to know Rinso's the only soap officially recommended by the makers of 33 leading washers, including the 1900 Whirlpool washer. But remember, there'll be no new 1900s made for some time to come. So give yours the best possible care and always use Soapy Rich Rinso on wash day.
Well, the only way we were able to get so much armament done during World War II was all civilian production of things like washing machines, automobiles, almost anything you could imagine was stopped. And all of these factories were turned over to wartime production. And so you really had to take care of your washing machine, because if it broke down, you were in big time trouble if you felt you needed to have one, because you couldn't get a new one.
You know where else you find that? Cuba. They're riding around in 1950 cars perfected to make them right.
Yeah. This was a common problem during World War II. Everything you were told, you had to wait till after the war to get it. It was a great incentive for people to want to have the war over, because you really needed a new car. You needed a new washing machine.
You wanted to eat some meat.
Yeah.
And the rations.
Well, and remember, people have a lot more money during the war than they did during the Great Depression. So they can actually afford to buy a new washing machine, buy a new car.
If there was one available.
If there were one available. So a lot of these advertisements you see for car makers will say, well, we're making airplanes right now, but once the war's over, come buy our new cars.
We have another message at the end of the Big Sister program pointing to another wartime shortage problem. So let's listen to that.
Hey, I hope you weren't one of the car owners who thought there'd be plenty of tires for everyone as soon as our synthetic rubber program got underway. Many people just took that for granted, you know. But actually, there never was any reason for doing so, because military needs for tires are very high. Tires for buses, trucks, airplanes, combat vehicles. And don't forget, our fighting men need rubber for bullet-sealing gas tanks, for life rafts and amphibious landing craft. So give your tires the best of care. Drive only when necessary. Keep under 35 miles per hour. Have your tires inspected regularly and recapped as soon as the tread is worn off. And drive carefully. Don't jam on your brakes or pick up speed suddenly. Conserve your tires and keep your car on war duty.
Now, this is mostly good advice for today.
Well,
no. Try enforcing that.
Yeah.
Recapping the tires,
yeah,
I would navigate.
I said mostly.
And you'd never get the public to drive under 35 miles an hour now on 55 mile an hour normal state speed limit. But rubber was in very short supply and in great demand from the military. And in fact, during World War II, gas was rationed. Not because there was a shortage of gas, but because it would force you to drive less if you couldn't get gas, and then you would conserve the rubber. Cars would have stickers on them depending on the what was determined to be your need for driving, and that would determine how much and how often you could put gas into your car.
Do you guys think that the troops were aware of these efforts domestically?
I suspect so. I mean, you've read some of these letters. They must talk about that.
They are aware of it. They are concerned sometimes that the civilians aren't as supportive as they should be. However, when you read some of like Army surveys about of soldiers who are on rotation, who go home for a month before they have to go back into the Army, a lot of times there are a lot of complaints about the lack of gasoline. You know, I think they became aware of the rationing only when they got back home and couldn't drive and couldn't get steak.
Right. Food was rationed. Everyone had ration books. I have mine still.
Really?
If we do it again and you guys want some coffee, you better be nice to me. I wasn't using my coffee ration, so. Anyway, they become really interesting things. A lot of people held on to them after the war was over. It's hard to conceive of today where we go to a store, we buy whatever we want, as long as we have the money to pay for it. During World War II, there were a lot of things you could not get, particularly food items, were really severely rationed, and thus a big black market grew up during the war, and there were other spots, we don't have any here, urging people not to buy things on the black market. Don't buy more than what your share is. One needs to be fair about it. Another thing that was, I think people who grew up during World War II will always remember, is that people had, well, housewives, had cans next to their stove where they would pour whatever fat in was left over from cooking, which was then being collected. Let's listen to a clip about that. This is from the end of a broadcast of the Lux Radio Theater, which is one of the really, really popular radio dramatic program. So let's hear the message about our fat.
And now here's a reminder from Uncle Sam to the housewives of America. Waste fats and greases from your kitchen are more urgently needed now than ever for use in the making of explosives and medicinal supplies. Every drop will contribute to saving American lives by ending this war sooner. Put your waste fats in a clean can and rush them to your butcher. He'll give you 2 free meat ration points besides 4 cents for every pound.
So, you know, it's interesting. We just had Professor Alan Rosenthal, who's now, I believe, about 80 years old, and at Rutgers in the Eagleton Institute. When I was at Hunter, and he was my teacher, he told me that the Boy Scouts played a huge role in going around and collecting this fat. And newspapers, by the way, and this fat. And he would talk about, you know, his role in doing that.
Well, what's interesting about this is a lot of the salvage campaigns, metal, paper, rags, really depended on children to do the collection. In this case, household fats, the weight was on women. But women had always been collecting these fats. In the 1930s, they collected these fats for cooking. What was hard for the government to do is to convince women that they should turn in these fats.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Really,
that's,
is.
That's why they gave you ration points, so mm-hmm. you could get more meat for your fat, in a sense. They mentioned in this little clip, you get a couple of points for that. And for a while, they were actually paying them a small nominal amount for this fat that was being turned in. So it became almost every household. You had this can where people would pour in the waste fat. You were talking before about Boy Scouts and children. Children really were a marshal into this. I remember as a small boy, I used to look around for people having thrown out wrappers that had foil on it. You would peel off the foil and save enough and turn into a great big ball of it, and you took it to an air raid warden's store, and you would get saving stamps for that, and if you got enough of those, you got a bond. So they were really encouraging kids to be involved in the warfare, and as mentioned, the waste paper and other things that kids would pick up. I guess those little the American Flyer wagons got to be really popular because kids would drag those along and throw all this stuff in to take and get something for it.
Well, and one point I think we didn't talk about earlier was that war bonds, the sale of war bonds, was not just designed to raise money for the war, but to get civilians to invest emotionally as well as financially in the war. So that was, again, mobilizing civilian support for the war.
Yeah, everyone had something they could do for the war effort. You know, you saved your fat, you collected the metals and the paper, and you bought bonds. We haven't talked about victory gardens, which was a big thing to do during the war. It's just fascinating. That was such an all-out effort to get the public behind it.
And there was a sense of community in the country, which we certainly haven't seen since that time.
No, not at all. Well, we're going to actually conclude with a song. I think World War II produced some of the greatest songs of American popular music genre ever. And we have a song that actually came out in 1944 after D-Day. And it talks about moving on now to end this war and march into Berlin. And there were several versions of it. The one we have here, I know Anne agrees with me, is the best one of all. With two very popular singing entities, Bing Crosby, of course, who everybody knew and was immensely popular at that time, and the Andrews Sisters, with whom he often made recordings. And the title of the song is There'll Be a Hot Time in the Town of Berlin. And I think we can end with that, and it's the march now through Germany.
There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. I want to be their boy, spread some joy when they take old Berlin. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Brooklyn boys begin to take the joint apart and tear it down when they take old Berlin. They're gonna start a row and show them how we paint the town back in Kokomo. They're gonna take a hike through Hitler's Reich and change that heil to what you know, Joe. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. You could never keep them happy down on the farm after they take Berlin.
Well, that was wonderful. Our guests have been Dr. Ivan Steen and Dr. Anne Pfau. Some of the clips you've heard are available at archive.org. This program has been conceived by the Center for Applied Historical Research and produced by David Gustina. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks for being with us.
I'm in the town of Berlin when the Brooklyn boys begin to take the joint apart and tear it down when they take old Berlin. They're gonna start a row and show them how you paint the town back in Michigan. They're gonna take a hike through Hitler's Reich and change the aisle to give me some skin. There'll be a hot time
in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go.